to ever beyond,
beyond, beyond, beyond, beyond.
Broadcast through the Wolf Spirit Media Network. Please join us in the chat room at wolfspiritmedia.net. Be prepared to leave your belief systems behind as we go beyond teachers, beyond gurus, beyond duality, ever beyond,
beyond.
Tune in with TalkStream Live, search for Ever Beyond. Also, you can call to listen on 712-432-9588. Selected archives are also available on my YouTube channel, Studio 9 Jam. You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio. You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio.
Yes, indeed. You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio. And just turn off. There we go. And welcome, everybody. I've just gone over to headphones. And I didn't have a guest sorted out for today, but I'm just talking to someone. Okay. Let's see if he's up for it. And we'll just go from there because Yes, Will, we're now on the air. So thank you very much for joining me. Tonight, my guest, very, very impromptu, and thank you so much for stepping into the fast moving groove that it is Robert D. Morningstar. And we've done some shows on the Monday show on Rev Radio before, but I kind of wanted to have you for myself, as it were, and take you into places that I know you go to, you've been to.
Very good.
And sort of more towards the esoterics and the frequencies and colors and lights and sound. That's the sort of stuff that I love to talk about. So, welcome to Ever Beyond, Robert. How are you doing? Oh, we lost you.
I'd be happy to do
so. Okay,
so I've been to do some for the JFK anniversary and going through the files and all those things, so very, very busy time. But I'm very happy to hear your voice and to be talking to your audience. I've always enjoyed the productions that you've done with me on Revolution Radio. So let's go at it. It's I love esoteric topics and
fabulous.
Out of the ordinary ideas. So.
Fabulous. Well, now, because it, you know, sometimes I heard you talking to Robin Falkov a few weeks ago, or a few days ago, and you were going into some very interesting areas there. For instance, right, the first thing that comes into my mind is the secret space program, and then it takes me back to my favorite subject, and you don't know this, but people on my radio station do, is time traveling Nazis.
Uh-huh.
And,
very interesting.
Yes.
Well, there is a basis in fact for that. So
oh, absolutely. I know.
I'm
I know.
Very
I know.
Interested in it. So what would you like me to say? My favorite example, or the one substantial possibility that we have proof that it happened, it would be the Kecksburg UFO crash.
Yes,
they call it a crash, but actually it was a controlled landing.
Yes, it didn't. It didn't drop out of the sky, did it?
I wish we had more time. No, it did not. Listen, I have the inside story on this thing. Because there is a friend of mine in Canada who has a UFO site in, what is this, in the northeast region of Canada. I think it's called HBC UFO, something like that. Anyway, he posted a tape many years ago, an audio tape of a call-in, which was from a man, now grown, who was a U.S. Air Force veteran. And he said that the reason that he joined the U.S. Air Force was that he was in the forest near Kecksburg that night when he saw this light, a strange light in the sky. And he was just hiking in the woods. This happened in late evening. It was not really, really late at night. I believe it was just, you know, just after sunset. Anyway, he saw this thing maneuvering, or it kind of looked strange, motions, side motions, up motions. And so he took his flashlight and he flashed his light at it. And when he flashed his light at it, the thing started to move down toward him, and that's when it came down into the forest. And he was the first person to arrive at the Kecksburg object. And he described strange writing around the base of it, that it looked something like a shell. He didn't use the word acorn, but that's what the fire department used in Kecksburg to describe what they found. And actually, the Kecksburg Fire Department made a model replica of the object and mounted it on the fire department, the firehouse in Kecksburg. And if you go to the internet, search around, you'll find this unusual photograph of the Kecksburg Fire Department, or the firehouse, with that object as they remembered seeing it when they arrived. So that may have been the bell, the famous De Glocke of the German research program, which was apparently based on spinning liquid mercury at superluminal speeds, at which time space-time changes occurred in the fabric of space-time and made it possible for them to travel through other dimensions to wherever they landed, and some people think it was Kecksburg.
Okay, so
another
Robert?
Interesting thing, if you want me to discourse on this, you've opened up, yeah, you've opened up a torrent, if you, okay. Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, so here's the thing. And we seem to have a very poor line connection when we're going back and forth. I think there might be a delay. I will have to maybe reset the call in a minute. But you're coming across all right, but there's a delay in us talking. So a couple of years ago...
I have 5 bars.
Okay, a couple of years ago, I came across a book which was an account from one of the scientists, one of the lead scientists from that Glocke project. His name was Otto Cerny. And he didn't escape he escaped Sporenberg. Sporenberg was, do you know who General Sporenberg was?
I'm not familiar with him.
All right.
I'm familiar with Hans Kammler and his project.
Okay, yeah.
Sporenberg.
Okay, so Sporenberg was between him and Hitler, between Kammler and Hitler, and he was the guy who had to clean the whole thing up if anything went wrong, which it did. And but the thing is that two scientists hid in the secret tunnels of the old castle. There are multiple layers of secret tunnels in the castle. They also allowed them access to the underground bases where they were doing all the work. But there were secret tunnels in the castle that allowed them to go and escape places. And anyway, the book that I got hold of was a collection of the journals of this guy. And it goes into very great detail, including the name of the extraterrestrial from Aldebaran who they contacted through the Vril Society and all of that. So we can explore that. But the actual reason for Kecksburg was quite accidental, in that it contained the lead scientist and his double agent girlfriend, Helga Wilhelm, and there are actually two people inside De Glocke. And when they got it to Edwards Air Force Base, and it had finally managed to cool down, this, you know, they hid this big clanking noise, a clunk, and the door opened, and out stepped this jackbooted Nazi from 1943. Have you heard that story? Robert? No. There you are.
Wow. But are we talking about what happened to the custom object that I was discussing that landed at Kecksburg, or is it another manifestation or apparition of the Glocka?
No, that is. All right. Okay, so let's zoom out a bit. Why did this thing appear? Okay, so the Allies were approaching Berlin. And various other places. Castle Katz is now in Poland. It was Germany at the time. And they were approaching it. And they, basically the Nazis didn't want anybody to get hold of this, any of the research. So, Hitler sent General Sporenberg to basically, kill everybody and bury it and get rid of all the evidence. And burn all the documents, etc. And so there was a battle between Rudolf Seeger, the lead scientist on the whole thing, with Sporenberg's detail of like 100 soldiers. He sent 100 Nazi soldiers, and this one guy kind of defeated the lot of them. You know, he set up booby traps and just he was amazing. Anyway, so this book is brilliant. It's got this Nazi on Nazi action at the end. So what's going on is that,
This sounds typical.
Sorry, Robert?
Right.
Well, we do have a long, long delay between us. So look, what happens is that, they also know that, Helga is a double agent. So, he grabs her and they ran and they got into the Glocka and cranked it up and turned it up further than anyone had ever done it. They made the mercury cylinders spin faster than anyone had ever done. Even Martin Bormann was getting scared when it went invisible. So it first of all levitates, and then there's a green glow, and then it pops out of existence, or it pops out of appearance. It phases out of dimension, and that's what Project Rainbow did as well. And then there's the blue lightning, and then it disappears. It leaves time and space, and then it reappeared some 20 years later. In another place. Now, what's really interesting is, why Germany to Kecksburg? Was there some attractor that drew Die Glocke to the place where it appeared? Interestingly, it's a place called Kecksburg. You know, the mountain of Keck. You know, the frog lord of chaos.
Yes.
There, Robert, I front-loaded you with a whole bunch of information that I have that I don't know if you've heard.
Yeah.
There is more, but basically, away you go.
Well, it does make sense to me that, the Germans were intent on coming to America. And also spying on America. So if the Glocka was a stealth vehicle, they may well have pre-planned destination or target zones in the craft that would lie in areas of America in which they would have an interest. And actually, Kecksburg, Pennsylvania is a pretty interesting place to land. You'd be in good cover. You know, deep forested area where you could land. It would be familiar also in terrain and vegetation to, let's call them explorers from the fatherland, who would be very adept at surviving
in the wild, especially if it was a very quick drop in and drop out type of spy mission that they had in mind for the future. Now, if they had to escape under duress, what would you punch into the computer first? Right?
Anywhere but here. Yeah.
Something already. Right, let's get out of here. We'll decide about where we're going later. That's what I think it would be a very logical thing to do. I don't think that they would let loose a time machine into space-time with no idea of the space-time coordinates of the region where they would want to arrive. I don't think anybody would be that mindless and foolhardy to think you could step into the void and then come back here when you didn't know where you went in the first place. So they must have had a very advanced physics applied, multidimensional physics navigation, kind of perhaps like Dune. Remember in Dune that the stellar navigation was so complex that only people ate the melange had, could have the consciousness expansion to be able to navigate the great ships of that empire. So I would think that the Germans would have converged on a similar idea. Some kind of navigation, the non-linear, non-three-dimensional navigation as a prelude before even attempting to jump into the void of a space-time machine like that.
Well, that's
well,
true.
Maybe you did. Thank you for alerting me to the general above power. That's very interesting. And, you know, the Germans, very mystical people, very psychic people. They were way ahead of, you know, consciousness-wise. The German consciousness was far more expanded on many of them than the average Joe, you know, the average American, or the average English men of those times, because the experimentation in expansion of mind, psychology, the experimentation with alternate forms of thought that occurred in Germany kind of springboarded them. And also there was that reaction. First there was the amazing bewilderment of the world that occurred after relativity theory was posited and proven to be relatively true. But then when the Nazis came to power, there was a reaction against Jewish physics, and Hitler demanded a totally new mind stream from the German people. And so there was a reaction to relativism, and maybe we'd call it absolutism, if I may, just to have dichotomy. So maybe this demand of Hitler to think in other directions, which gave birth to the thoughts of Hans Horbinger. You know, folks, the Germans didn't think the universe was anything like we think it is. Do you know the theories, cosmogony or cosmology of Hans Horbinger, the official Nazi philosopher, a physicist philosopher? The theory of fire and ice. It would go very well with fire theory. It's kind of a yin and yang theory. The Vril came, the Vril is that underlying energy, you know, the force that permeates everything. And I think that's what Wilhelm Reich was calling orgone, coining an English, an American word for it. However, the demand for this new kind of thinking produced Hans Horbinger, and he believed that our eyes create an illusion in our perceptions, and that the universe is really a sphere, a globe that has ice at the farthest reaches of it, and in the center is the sun, and that we are creatures of fire and ice. And he began to create a whole new idea of looking, of how to look, perceive reality. So that's what I mean by German consciousness had jumped, had kind of made a leap beyond the normal three-dimensional matrix that most people still live under today. Although space-time is a little more flexible in the consciousness of modern man than it was in those of the 1940s and 50s. And here we're talking about 1930s. Also, Germany exposed itself very openly to Orientalism and occult experimentation. Many lodges, similar to Crowley's Lodge, took root in Germany and began exploring the magical universe. And some melded and wedded each other into secret societies, which were then enlisted entire into branches of German occult research. Not the least of which was the root race, the search for the German root race and the work of the Ahnenerbe. I know we have a delay. You want to go at it?
Wow. Okay. So let me just add, Sporenberg was later captured by the Russians, and much of the information in the general domain comes from the interview notes. I use the word interview loosely, that Sporenberg received, that were received from Sporenberg about what Die Glocke was about. So because he had...
This is KGB? KGB stuff?
KGB captured Sporenberg and
right.
Interrogated him. And so a lot of what people know about Die Glocke
right.
were from the notes that were taken from his interrogation by the Russians. That's where a lot of the public domain knowledge comes.
Tell me more.
So, well, this is, that's more or less it. That's, there are many, not many people speak about Die Glocke, right? There are very, very few original documents about it. And one of the original documents is the interview notes from, General Sporenberg. And so obviously he didn't know everything about the project. Now, the other information is that what was taken from the Project Paperclip. Now, what's interesting is that the Paperclip was one of the places that the... Now, do you remember I said that there were four people that escaped? Two of them in Die Glocke. And the other two escaped in the secret tunnels. And the eventually they were picked up by the Allies, and they were brought over in Operation Paperclip and embedded into NASA. Okay, one of them was called Wolf Davis,
right?
And one of them was called Otto Cerny. I believe Otto was not as public as Wolf Davis. Wolf Davis is known about, but nobody knows about this other guy. He may have a different name. You know, they were very, very much bleached and renamed, and, you know, Dr. Bischoff becomes Dr. Bishop sort of thing. But anyway, so what happens is,
right.
is that when they pick up Die Glocke and bring it back to Edwards Air Force Base, who is there but Otto Cerny, who had worked on that very project 20 years in his timeline ago. And so when Rudolf Seeger stepped out of Die Glocke, he had just seen him like a couple of hours before, but Otto had not seen him for 20 years.
20 years, boy, that is something. You know what that reminds me of? Exactly the same theme in the movie The Time Machine. The protagonist, I forgot his name. It's H.G. Wells actually writing The Time Machine. He makes a stop in 1916 where his friend has died, and he meets his son.
and he says hello to him just as he's going off to World War One. Then he gets in the time machine again. He climbs up in 1966, and he meets him again, but now the son of his friend is now an old man, and he remembers seeing him, and he says, oh, my God, you haven't changed. How can that be? And then he runs away just before the atomic attack on London begins. Yeah, so that is the paradox. Time travel does involve a lot of mysteries and paradox. I think one of the best time travel movies I've ever seen is called Millennium. Have you seen that one with Cheryl Ladd and Kris Kristofferson? It is very interesting. Beautiful.
It's been a while, I think. I can't remember. I'm sure
really
I saw it.
Pleiadian. She's depicted as, you know, this basically. Yeah, beautiful. Yeah, beautiful blonde goddess. And she keeps appearing in Kris Kristofferson's life from childhood to his middle age. And it has to do with him having survived an airline crash in which he should have died. And the thing devolves around extraterrestrials who come in and snatch souls and snatch people out of airliners and take them to the future and let the airliner crash with, you know, like synthetic bodies.
But I'm getting so many goosebumps
now. So
that they
can disperse them into different epochs of time to try to keep the timeline stable. And the problem is that if they go into the past and alter it too radically, time quakes unfold so that their future feels the changes. If they alter some element in the past, that time stream or that timeline is altered forever, and the one that has been will collapse because of tampering with the past. Another wonderful experience of time travel is Time and Again by Jack Finney. This is the ultimate time travel novel, and it deals with a CIA experiment in time travel. When they get the idea, sometime in the 1960s, late early 70s, that they really still want to get rid of Castro, but they haven't been able to, so they concoct this idea that they're going to send a time traveler back and try to alter history back there in the past in order to prevent Castro from coming to power. And they train this individual in how to time travel, and it has to do all with consciousness, with detaching your consciousness and your body from this space-time matrix and being able to access the loci or the location points of the space-time of 1888, for example. And it's a marvelous story, and it's very coherent and logical. And that's one thing that sometimes time travel movies fail. There's a tragic flaw in their timeline concepts. But the ones that Back to the Future are really very good, too. They weren't bad. But that's predictive programming, you know, to acclimatize us to the idea. Because our entire notion of physics has changed in the last 15 years, and it's radically changing more and more rapidly with each ensuing year.
It is indeed, Robert. And so there was...
Time lag.
Yeah, long time lag. It's all right. It's smooth from the audience's point of view. I'll do something about the call in a little while. So there we are, and there was another problem. Because the red mercury that was in this, in the Glocker itself was not the only red mercury in its batch. And it turns out that every batch of red mercury is quantum entangled, which means that if you make one batch that is like running on a UFO and it started to become a gravity generator, then all the other pieces of that batch will also go quantum at the same time. And it turned out that there was a very, very serious problem that occurred because...
No matter where they are.
no matter where you are. Further down the road, Dr. Strangelove himself, Werner Eckert, was experimenting with some stolen red mercury that he stole from the project. And it caused a rip in space-time that was threatening to remove most of Area 51 in 1965. Over.
My goodness.
I've never heard of that. But are you saying that the mercury was in quantum entangled, and that if you had a batch of mercury in point A and point B and point C, if one went into that quantum state, the others in other machines would go, or just that one batch altogether? I didn't quite understand if it was that or separate clumps of the mercury would all...
I think it's just one batch.
Said, going into that higher energy state.
Just one batch. It's like cell mates or, you know, egg mates or something like that. They all go together.
You know what I wanted to say? That the idea for the Glocka appears to have gotten to the Germans by their reading of the Mahabharata, the ancient Hindu text. And a parallel to that occurred in 2010, 2008, something like that, that when Indira Gandhi ordered all Indian scientists to go and revisit their literature, the Mahabharata and the Vedas, and try to extract from them the technology that is described, specifically talking about the Vimana.
Absolutely.
And I've heard that NASA also followed up, and that this idea of vorticular mercury, liquid mercury engines was a key to it. So I'm not surprised that the Germans, who were, as I said, they were so advanced in all of these fields. For philology, the study of the evolution of languages, they were the ones who realized that we speak Indo-European languages, and that the word for breath in German is the same as the word for God's breath in ancient India, which is Atman. The Brahmanatman, you know, the Brahmanatman, the creator of God concept of ancient India. And the Germans say, you know, their breath is Atman. So they were the first to make that connection and see how languages evolved. And so they were looking for, as I referred to before, the Anunnaki was looking for the German root race, which they backtracked, which is the center of magical thinking on this planet, as far as I see, particularly when we're talking about Buddhism, you know. And the other thing that I also point out to people is that this Tibetan connection to Germany and to the Nazis is integral to understanding the social structure, the pyramid structure that the Nazis imposed on Germany, because it was no different than the political structure of Tibet, with the Dalai Lama at the pinnacle of that pyramid and all of the other sects descending in a pyramidal form. And now we come to the crux of the matter. Tibetan Buddhism is an overlay over a far older religion that was native to Tibet before Buddhism arrived. And it was basically a Führer cult that required human sacrifice to demonstrate fealty to the Führer, or the Dalai Lama. Every 7 years, all the tribes of Tibet had to go to Lhasa and sacrifice every 10th man, human sacrifice, as a form of fealty, loyalty, and sign of submission. So Buddhism came into Tibet and overlaid this religion, which is called Bon, B-O-N. And it's a very rare thing. Very few books are written about it, but I learned about Bon in 1996 and then followed up and scoured the world and found one book about it in English, but it's this migrated into Nazi philosophy of state and also the Nazi philosophy of reality. They were, and KGB were out to get all of the magical tricks and powers of the lamas. They knew that Tibetan lamas and the Tibetan monks had very advanced, extremely advanced psychic powers and abilities. And this is one of the most significant connections. It's also connected, Tibet is also connected directly to Rasputin in Russia, because I found out that Rasputin had a guru, and that guru was a Tibetan, fled to Moscow, and he studied under a Tibetan guru. And I say fled to Moscow because if you read a book called Red Shambhala by a Russian professor, Alexander Jedinovsky, I believe is his name. You can look it up on Amazon. It's called Red Shambhala. And it deals with how the communist regime in Moscow hijacked the legend of Shambhala in order to conquer Eurasia or Central Asia. They knew that the Central Asians had a myth of a coming Messiah and a coming kingdom, Shambhala, and that this idea had been percolating in Central Asia amongst all the Mongolian and Turkic tribes of this coming kingdom, Shambhala, since the 1200s. So being very astute psychologists and propagandists, they seized on the idea of stealing the Shambhala myth and convincing these Mongolian and Turkic tribes and regions, Kyrgyzstan, Turkestan, Mongolia, that Shambhala, this universal kingdom of brotherly love, the legend said it would come from the north. So they said, oh, we're Moscow, we're in the north. We've had this revolution for the universal man. Let's convince them that we are Shambhala. So they went and sent agents to proselytize and gradually convince the Central Asian, Turkic, Uyghur, and Mongolian people that Russia, Soviet Union, was the coming of Shambhala, and thereby were able to use that to insinuate themselves there and subvert each of those countries to communism. Over to you.
Wow. Wow. Okay.
So the occult, really. The occult is at the basis of all power, I have to say. You see, and then, of course, when power is assumed, they have to hide the source of their power. And it's the same whether we're talking about Hitler, the Gestapo, the Weibelberg's castle, the Freemasons, the Jesuits. It's all occult power, and all occult power has to do with being able to access that other dimensional source of all energy, of all power, the interdimensional space. Scalar weapons are based on accessing scalar power, and that is occult. Even if you use gadgetry like the CERN particle accelerator, or Brookhaven,
yeah. So yes, indeed. Here's my theory, Robert, about CERN. Yeah. Okay, so just consider, it's just a matter of scale. Diglocker was counter-rotating 2 tons of, or a ton, or half a ton of mercury in each of these things. So basically they were firing something very, very fast, then you have a magnetic field that is going in the opposite direction.
Yes.
Very, very fast. That's exactly what CERN is doing. So it must be doing the same thing.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a very dangerous thing. Like HAARP, you know, the HAARP installation in Alaska.
Yeah.
No, there are a lot of reasons for having it. I'll tell you, know, a lot of people don't understand the purpose of HAARP, and it's basically an anti-ballistic missile defense system. And let me explain to you how this would work as an anti-ballistic missile defense system. The HAARP facility is capable of oscillating the aurora borealis in the same manner as if you and I, JP, stood on opposite ends of a very, very long curtain, very high and long curtain. And if we started shaking each side, we'd impart waves to the curtain that would oscillate and pass down the curtain. Now, if we were in sync with each other, we could create waves that would amplify each other by being in harmony with each other, which would be waves that amplify each other. At the same token, if we were in opposition, we could have create waves that would just clash in the center and neutralize each other and create a more, let's call it a destructive force, destructive to the wave and its continuity. So they discovered that they can oscillate the aurora borealis and create waves of different density to pass. They can also create concentrations of plasma, which is exactly what the aurora borealis is. It's plasma. So they can create clusters of plasma and move them very rapidly across. And when they do that, these clusters take on a red glow, a very brilliant ruby red glow, and they look like red ruby UFOs, and they'll zip almost at the speed of light from one end of the sky to the other. So how this would work would be this. If, for example, North Korea were to launch hydrogen nuclear bombs on ballistic missiles coming over the regions of Alaska, the HAARP instrument would begin a very vigorous oscillation and a condensation, basically, of the aurora borealis, creating a tremendous geomagnetic electrical storm, so that as the missile and the warhead passed through that cloud of plasma, the plasma would fry all of the internal components and neutralize the trigger, and so that the warhead would drop like a dud, like a dummy, because having passed through the condensation of the aurora borealis, it would have been fried in flight and could not detonate. That's basically one of the theories underlying the HAARP experiment.
Robert.
The other one. Yes, go ahead.
I have a corresponding theory that the Norway spiral in Tromsø,
yes,
was exactly that. Is that they created a counter-rotating electromagnetic field that if you were to watch that film and think, say there was some kind of force beam that would turn something into a particle that would, instead of moving in a forward direction, was then suddenly sent in a 90-degree direction. You know, instead of it, like, turning its energy from its kinetic form to a electric form,
yes,
and changing its, and that changes its direction, that essentially the it was projecting a dome shield, and it caused that thing to vaporize, and what you're seeing is the is it spinning and dissipating. That's my theory when I was looking at that.
I agree with you. And the other interesting thing is that several investigators, including Hoagland and I, found that there are two HAARP stations. The HAARP in Gaukona, Alaska is not the only HAARP station now. It's become a wide network across the world with scaled down but equally powerful, or scaled down and even more powerful, portable HAARP stations. And that is mobile HAARP stations that can be moved along on large flatbed trucks and opened up to do their work. And there are two stations there that were beaming at that particular time. I thought that it was a big propaganda well, a propaganda ploy, showing off, also psychological warfare, implying that Obama was the Messiah. Remember, he was up there to get the Nobel Prize at that time?
Oh, yeah, he'd just been elected.
Yeah.
But here's the thing, Robert. Sean Morton has various insider contact, or certainly had at that time. And they were saying that that also had something to do with a cooling down of the sun, which means that they must have taken some kind of solar energy. They must have literally sucked plasma out of the sun in order to make that thing work.
I don't think that's necessarily true.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's ample energy inside the Earth. There is ample energy inside the Earth and in the atmosphere, which, if harnessed, would give us all the power we need to do such things. One of the things that we need to recognize is that lightning is constant around the world. The Earth is struck by 50 million volts of bolts. 50 million bolts of lightning strike the Earth every day. And that energy, telluric energy, is coursing through the Earth. These are the kinds of things that Tesla was thinking about harnessing or tapping. So I think that given the secret space program, the secret physics program, the forbidden physics program, that they've already moved far along these lines. I believe that it would be possible to harness these lightning storms by building towers. For example, the Rocky Mountains are full of crystalline rock, and crystalline rock is piezoelectric. And under the forces of, for example, lunar gravity moving across, I believe that that induces electrical activity. And if these electrical storms are happening in known areas, there's a place in Florida called Lightning Alley, you know, and then there are regions like that in the Rocky Mountains. I think that if they built, towers to tap this energy, they could actually harness it and feed it into a new national electromagnetic grid.
Get this, Robert. My theory on pyramids. Okay.
Oh.
Wardenclyffe Tower was a development by Tesla about his understanding that the Earth is just completely electric. There's loads of electricity all over the place. And all you need to do is to collect it is to have two things in a different place. And so if you have, for instance, a metal sphere attached to a wire that takes you to ground, and then you raise that metal sphere up a very high tower, you'll get a potential from it. And you can use that electricity, and you can even have a little what's known as a jewel thief and tiny things, but Tesla created this thing, Wardenclyffe Tower. But
yes, I saw it. I've seen pictures of him sitting inside with the electric arcs going all over the place.
Exactly. So there's loads of juice there, right? So here's my theory, right, Robert? I got loads of theories. I love to test them against people. Hey. What do you think of this one? Right. So the Great Pyramid, or all pyramids, in fact, some of them don't have capstones. And I believe that the reason that they don't have capstones is because they were made of gold or some other very good conductor. And there were also gold cables that form coils all the way down and up. Back, you know, there were two sets of coils inside the great inside the shell of the Great Pyramid.
Yes.
And that the chamber, the king's chamber of the Great Pyramid, is set at a harmonic point, the two-thirds of the way, or one-third of the way up. And you have an oscillator that creates 108 cycles a second.
Yes.
Which, now, pyramids, right? Here's the thing.
Right.
the pyramid form has a particular effect, and it tends to, have you noticed this, it dehydrates fruit. You know about this little factor.
Yes. I actually I have three pyramids in my apartment, and I've been working with pyramids since the mid-1970s.
All right. So my theory on pyramids is that they turn water into plasma. All right?
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, right. Stick one on your head, and you reduce the pressure in your head.
Yeah, but you might have dried up the water in your brain.
Yeah, well, maybe there's plenty.
I think I'll keep my cerebrospinal fluid for a little while.
So here's the thing. I've got loads of theories about the pyramids, right?
Let me just say this. Yeah. When you mentioned the word oscillator, what came to my mind is that secret chamber that's just been discovered with the muon photographs. You know, they've been scanning it for over a year or 2 years.
Sorry, I just hit my, I just accidentally pressed the keyboard with my foot. all the drama sounds, yeah.
Well, it's a great sound for what I was going to say. You talked about, creating an oscillator with objects in two different spots. It occurred to me that this chamber, the secret chamber that they've discovered, it's a hollow space inside the pyramid adjacent to the Grand Gallery and about level between the Grand Gallery and the King's Chamber. And when I looked at this, let's call it an X-ray. It's not an X-ray. It's a Mu-ray. But when I looked at the chamber, I thought to myself of what would be like to be in there and nothing inside it. And I felt oscillations, a resonance happening. And that chamber could be analogous to the chamber that is used in a cyclotron to create microwaves. You know, it spins around and sends the wave into a certain cavity that makes it change shape and amplifies it. And I thought that this relationship of the Great Pyramid, the Grand Gallery, the King's Chamber, to this newly discovered hollow space could be analogous to a gigantic cyclotron that may be working not with microwaves, but with gravity waves.
Okay, right. So here we go. Here's some more of the theory, and we'll put all these things together, Robert, I think.
Okay,
so now, we've established that Wardenclyffe Tower generated power because it held a great big sphere up in the air. Simply that. Simply the potential difference between the two potential points of the ionic levels of the lower atmosphere, right? So then we have massive coils that are wrapped around the pyramids going down and up. You know, counter-rotated coils.
Mm-hmm.
There's also shafts, they call them, with odd copper fitments in them. Yes. Now, to an electrician, you'd see, that's an electrode. You'd clamp something onto that.
Right.
So I believe that that's where the gold cables came in.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the gold cables came down into the King's Chamber, or wherever they went to, and would connect with the Ark of the Covenant, or whatever it was called in those days before it was the Ark of the Covenant. That essentially it's a large capacitor. It's a scaled up version of the cigarette lighter, where you hammer a little crystal, and the juice that comes out of the crystal is enough to jump a spark.
You know what's strange?
What's
strange? You're the second person in 2 hours to mention that to me on the radio. Because I was doing a show with a gentleman who worked on the HARP facility, assembling it, and suffered a lot of consequences, physical consequences from the radiation. But we were talking about artificial intelligence and artificial intelligence towers that they're putting out all over the country and the 5G network that's going to monitor everything. He said that he had just discovered a way of basically neutralizing them for a short period of time. And he said that if you got within 300 feet of one of these towers and flicked a cigarette lighter that has that crystal, that a microelectromagnetic pulse from the lighter would frazzle the tower, the 5G tower, for 1 or 2 seconds. And I said, that's not very long. He said, but imagine 1,000 people approaching them and going at the same time. You could fry that. So it's just uncanny that you mentioned the same crystal phenomenon inside the lighter.
Okay, so let's talk crystal technology. When you squeeze a crystal, you get juice out of it. That's called the piezo effect. Okay, so imagine and you put a couple of end caps on it, you know, golden end caps or pressure, like the cat's whisker of the radio, and those are your electrodes. So if you were to somehow vibrate that crystal into a useful kind of get the right frequency that'll get the most juice out of it, you know, rather than blunt hitting it with a hammer, you know, you hit it with sound, which makes it vibrate in its most optimal way, say at 108 cycles a second. Say that's the same frequency that the scarab beetles use to levitate their way around the world.
Right.
Say you've got that frequency humming into that crystal. Then you're holding that crystal inside a box that is insulated and covered in metal. That is a charge. That is a capacitor. Yeah. So basically, you've got a crystal generator going into a very large capacitor, and on the top of it, you've got these what they call the cherubim, and they. They look like very ornate, but, essentially functional, electrodes. But and you know, the spark would jump proven. Across those things. Okay, go ahead.
You're proven correct. Everything you said is absolutely true and has been proven scientifically. Back in the late 1960s, the University of Michigan Physics Department, got on a project. It was a student project. They read the Bible. They read about the Ark of the Covenant, and then they constructed to the letter what they conceived was described in the Bible, and they built a model of the Ark of the Covenant made out of gold. And what happened was they had to destroy it because it was charging up with so much electricity that people were in danger of getting electrocuted.
Okay, so let's add the data points.
Absolutely right.
Let's add some data points here, right?
Go ahead.
Okay, so first of all, there's something unusual about how you get into the so-called King's Chamber. And that is that there's, now I've never been there, but you know, I've done a lot of study on it. And
I've been there in remote viewing. I've been there. And you have to bow deeply.
Exactly.
Under the porticulus there.
Yeah, so I'll tell you why that is.
Go ahead.
Because the Ark of the Covenant is the spark of the covenant. It is a massive arc welding machine thing.
Right.
Right? It creates an enormous arc.
Well, it's killed people. It's in the Bible.
It generates ultraviolet light. That is damaging to people and will kill you by your skin, you know. And that's why they had to wear all this body armor. And they had to look through crystals.
The jewels, you know, the 12 jewels that the priests had to wear on the chest, the Urim and Thummim.
Yeah, and they had to wear these crystals on their eyes, which is basically a welding mask.
Wow.
You see? Now it's making more sense. It's more
the ones on the eyes, but the rest of it all makes sense. There's shielding against some kind of radiation.
Yes.
Makes sense.
Okay, so.
But it always struck me in the Bible that God was so hostile, you know, that the story was that at one point they were conveying the Ark of the Covenant and something happened. It was about to fall over, and some devotee went and tried to push it back on, and he did. He pushed it back on, but he was killed because he touched it. And again, there is that electromagnetic characteristic of this device that, as I said, was proven by University of Michigan experiments when they had to destroy the one they built.
Because it would build up such a charge that it could, right. You know, basically you're talking like, these substations that kids climb onto and get zapped and end up fried.
Yeah.
But so, mm-hmm. Okay, so, all right. So another thing about the Ark of the Covenant is that it's a gravity generator, and that the sticks that they had, they weren't to hold it up. They were to hold it down. People loaded
that's
down.
That's an interesting idea. Right? That's a very interesting idea.
Because they used it to repel the water to get across the Jordan, didn't they?
Repel the water of the Red Sea.
That was one thing. That was another. No, there was some other time when they had to kind of cross a river.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not sure of it, but I'm sure it was like something like the Jordan. But basically, they took the Ark of the Covenant and they walked across, and it just repels everything.
Uh-huh.
And so it repelled the water.
I have to familiarize myself with that chapter.
Yeah, there's a second time when they used the Ark of the Covenant to cross water. So there's all this, and it's got every same property as a gravity generator. Okay. So yes. The other thing about the Holy of Holies, or, you know, it's just blinding light, and they, you know, it's literally blinding light. And that's why nobody's supposed to put their eyes on it. It would kill you. Yes. It would fry your retinas, and they go, you know, cloudy vision.
The same thing happens with UFOs. That's why I tell people, don't look directly at them. People have had the corneas blistered because they emit actinic rays. It depends on the energy state it's in. You know, when it's in the red state, the yellow state, but when it gets into the blue and the white state, which is the highly energetic state of a UFO, it's producing radiation that can burn your skin or actually cause blisters on your eyes, like, Hollywood actors used to suffer that from Klieg lights back in the 1920s and 30s.
Same technology. They're arc lights, aren't they? Carbon arc.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So listen, Robert,
yes, sir.
Let's have a quick bit of Frank, just to keep the New York thing going. Everybody, you know, people are bursting for a bladder release. So it's time for a quick break, and we'll be back in 3 minutes.
Very good.
You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio.
Yes, you are. You're listening to Ever Beyond on Ever Beyond Radio on Wolf Spirit Radio. Today, we're talking time-traveling Nazis, Vedas, Ayurvedas, wherever you've been, Vimana. Oh, God, I miss my Vimana. I had one once, I'm sure. Because, you know, I'm really interested in the whole subject. So, you know, and quite deeply. So let's just kind of wheedle back there. Because we had now, oh God, there were so many things that you talked. The synchronicity thing.
Oh, that is very strange. There must be a message there.
There is synchronicity that is going on. Really, it's like somebody's turned up the knob. So it turned up the synchronicity control. Okay, you know, I remember, you know, you used to say, oh, I added a synchronicity a few weeks ago. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, it's an everyday occurrence.
Now it's almost momentary, you know, moment by moment.
We're paying attention.
Yeah.
That's what I mean by the consciousness has expanded. People are listening to the higher self. And I think the higher self speaks to us non-verbally through symbolic events, synchronicity, one being one of them, psychic experiences, remote dreams, remote viewing, precognition. We're all developing it. It was suppressed. It was intentionally suppressed by the priesthood of science for 50 years, but we're humans. We're irrepressible. These are our gifts. These are our faculties. And you telling me that I can't dream the future does not make that true. I could dream the future because it may be fixed, but I could also dream the future because I have the power to create the future. And I think it's a bit of both of those.
Well, I think that from what I understand, we've been used to create a future against our better nature, and now we're in the process of piece by piece deprogramming and reprogramming. Deprogramming and reprogramming our original kind of path to where we what we were supposed to be doing in the first place. But at the same time, having been drawn off our path, having been diverted, we've learned so much more. So we're kind of further along the line. So, you know, it's all good, as they say. Oh, God, it's been a bit of a journey.
I don't believe that. It's not all good. It may be all for the better,
yeah,
but it's not good.
So anyway, meanwhile, here's some more thoughts, right? So there we go. We're in the king's chamber in the pyramid,
mm-hmm.
and there is an arc going on, and you don't want to be able to look into it. So I believe that there was the place outside of that, you know, the gallery that goes into the chamber itself. The outside was a place where people could stand and not be blinded. You know, their legs would be illuminated, but their eyes would be protected. So I believe that was one thing.
That's very interesting. Very interesting idea. That it was forcing you to bow down was to shield your eyes from the luminosity that was present in the king's chamber.
That's right. So only people with protective clothing, the right robes, right? Things that maybe had a certain dye that mm-hmm. was proof of ultraviolet light.
I sure wear my Ray-Bans.
Yeah, totally.
Listen, let me share something with you about the Great Pyramid. You and I have studied the Great Pyramid probably since we were children, and I have gone in-depth into it. And I had a remote viewing experience of the Great Pyramid back in 1979, and this occurred, actually this was 1980, and this occurred exactly 1 year after my grandfather died. And as a child, my father was a merchant marine captain and was not home a lot. And so my grandfather was my closest, father figure, you might call him.
Uh-huh.
But when he died, I didn't feel a thing. A year later, I was in deep, deep black sleep, and suddenly I found myself in the Great Pyramid. I was dressed in white, very much like the Druids dressed. I was walking through the pyramid, through every chamber as if I knew it, like the back of my hand. And I very casually walked up the Grand Gallery, took the giant step, bowed before the portcullis, pressed in, and saw the sarcophagus in the center of the King's Chamber. I walked over to the sarcophagus, expecting it to be empty, but no. There was my grandfather, lying in state with his arms crossed across his chest, dead, as dead as Ramesses. And I was looking at him, contemplating him from the base of, as I would say, from the feet. And suddenly he rose up and looked, opened his eyes, stared into my eyes, raised his right hand in a fist, and he said, "Son, now we have the power." And what he was saying to me is, "Son, grandson, I'm dead, but I'm alive and awake here on the other side, and you are alive and awake on that side, and the two of us together, now we have the power," meaning completeness, communication, communion. And it's always been a very inspiring memory to me because it was as vivid as this room is now. And that's one of the distinctions of a very powerful remote viewing experience and a dream. Dreams are very nebulous and wispy, but remote viewing is as solid as it is here. So I wanted to share that with you as my personal experience of the Great Pyramid. Do you have Great Pyramid decoded? by Peter Lemessurier.
I think I might have read it years and years and years back.
That's a masterpiece. And Peter Tompkins' book is also... Peter Tompkins' book gave me an insight into Mars. There's an article on the internet called The Four Faces of Mars, A Night to Remember, that I wrote back around 1997. And it had to do with an insight that came to me after I saw an aerial or a satellite image of Cydonia, the Tarsus Mountains, the three great volcanoes that lie to the west of the Valles Marineris, and northwest of that is Olympus Mons. So the three greatest volcanoes in our solar system are, you know, situated right there. So I saw this huge panoramic view of Mars, and all of a sudden, Peter Tompkins' book and the chart of the three pyramids of Giza and the outlying area to the west, which is called the Qatar Basin. The Qatar Basin is the deepest, lowest area of the Mediterranean. It's 450 feet below sea level. And then it rises into these mountains that separate Egypt from Libya. And in those mountains is the holiest mountain in Egypt, and it's called Al-Wajit. And when I saw this chart drawn by the expedition of Piazzi Smith back in the 1800s, and I juxtaposed it with the panoramic view of Mars, I realized that the Giza Plateau is a terraformed image of Olympus Mons, the Tarsus Mountains, Solus Lacus, and the Valles Marineris. It was terraformed and to point to the planet Mars. The three pyramids represent the three volcanoes of the Tarsus Mountains. And this Al-Wajit is the real Mount Olympus. In our culture, it is the real Mount Olympus, Al-Wajit, in Western Egypt. That corresponds to Olympus Mons on Mars. Now, that's a crazy idea, except for one thing that proves me right. The legend says that Alexander the Great, when he died, was carried back to Egypt in state. And then he was buried with the gods on Mount Olympus. Now, in Greece, there is a Mount Olympus, and they've searched for 2,300 years for the tomb of Alexander the Great, and they didn't find a bone. But in 1994, at the base of this mountain called Al-Wajit, in a little town called Siwa, they found a burial chamber, and they found the body of Alexander the Great. And that's my proof that Al-Wajit is Mount Olympus, and that doesn't prove that it corresponds to Mars, but when you see the two charts, the panoramic view of Mars, the Valles Marineris, Solus Lacus, which is a huge depression, a meteor impact area on Mars, the three volcanoes corresponding to the three pyramids, and Mount Olympus on Mars corresponding to Al-Wajit, you can only say they terraformed it like a Japanese garden, with three pyramids that are pointers. And there's a lot of red stone in the pyramids. And it says to me, look up in the sky, look for something red, find it, go there, and see what you see. And I think that that's what the pyramids are. They are pointers to the planet Mars.
Okay, so there's Mars, right? And then there's also the Orion thing.
Yes.
The idea that... So this extends it. So here's my, again, all right, so you take us to Mars, let's talk about Mars. There was some fella who used to chase Richard Hoagland around and really harangue him and say, you're not telling us the whole truth, are you? And Hoagland would never say anything. And it turns out that what he was saying, what he was trying to get Hoagland to say was that there is not only one face on Mars, that there are thousands. The place is covered in them, as you've been talking about.
Yes,
here's the thing. Here is my Well, I don't think it's much of a theory, because I've discussed it with an extraterrestrial, and he says that's the way, yeah. Okay, so here's the thing. If you come from Orion and you're fizzling around the planet, you look back at where you came from, and you look down on the Earth, and you see if you can find a pattern that matches that. Oh, look, here's Egypt. I came from Orion.
You're right.
How about that?
That's interesting. Oh, there's one more detail about this discovery or association that I make between the Giza Plateau, the Qatar Basin, and the mountain range, which the Libyan mountains, I would say, Al-Wajit. And this, I lost my train of thought.
The base.
Al-Wajit. Yes, the base of Al-Wajit. Here's another thing about it. Here it comes. There is an association of miraculous healing powers with this site called Siwa. And it is that there is an oasis there that people in Egypt have been going to for millennia for healing, magical healing or miraculous healings. And, I got this information. I found out the name was Al-Wajit, and I have Egyptian friends in New York. They were tailors and haberdashers. So I said, hey, fellas, you know, I found this and this, and I showed it to them, and they were agog. And I said, but I can't find out what Al-Wajit means. And I said, do you know what Al-Wajit means? And he said to me, oh, that means I found it. I said, what? He says, it's a statement. It's like saying, I found it. I said, oh, like Eureka in Greek. And he said, yes, I found it. And I thought that was the most unusual, amazing name. But the point I was making, and it did come back to me, sorry I get sidetracked. In addition to Al-Wajit, Mount Olympus, the Qatar Depression, and Solus Locus, the three volcanoes in the Tarsus Mountains with the three pyramids, there is the Valles Marineris, which is a crack that runs 2,400 miles across Mars. Well, guess what? There is a crack in the Earth that runs about 1,500 miles on the east coast of Africa, which is called the Great African Rift Valley. And I think that clinches it, that Martians came to Earth. They look down, and I call them the Martian survivors, because I believe that our human race was engendered, nurtured on Mars, and that the Martian cataclysm caused the need for a Noah's Ark that came here. And they dropped, the survivors, the Martian remnant, as I call them, dropped into different regions of the Earth, including Egypt and Sumeria and the Andes, and Easter Island, and the South Pacific, and Central China, and dispersed themselves, and that then we began to reconstitute not just the Martian culture, but the Martian genome. And I believe that the human gene came from Mars, and then it was transferred to a proto-hominid, and the reason was that the Martians who survived knew that their gestation periods were too long, that they were too few in number, and that they only hope for the survival of the Martian race was to hybridize, to hybrid a cross between the Martian gene pool and this proto-hominid or pre-human being, and that when they crossed that, they produced the man of red dirt, Adam. That's what Adam means, the man made of red clay. And I believe that that is an allegory and a pointer to the fact that human origins came from the red planet, and so we are red men. As I said to you on your show before, the greatest trick the English people played on the rest of the world is to convince them that they're white. Because you guys are red, you're pink, you're rosy, and you're not, unless you're an albino, you guys ain't white. But you fooled enough people into thinking so. No, we're
anything but white, yeah. So look, Yeah. All right, because, you know, now you're talking about the Martian destruction, and that takes me to the story of Maldek and the Pleiadian operation to destroy the reptilian base on Maldek.
Well, yeah.
That's, you know, that really takes it back. I mean, let me just hit the time machine button one or two times. Here we go. There we go. Oh. 120 million years back.
Yeah, well, how about the idea that there was a war? What created Solus Locus? What cracked the planet? What created the Tarsus bulge, and what cracked the Valles Marineris? Asteroid impacts, right? Where's the likeliest source of the asteroids for striking Mars? Well, obviously it's the asteroid belt. Well, how did it get there? Well, I believe that the Bible does tell of a cosmic battle in the heavens, and the legends also, the legend of Marduk, the destruction of the planet that was called Marduk. That was actually a war between Mars, the Martians, and some other civilization that was in that ring that would have been the fifth planet. That ring that the Anunnaki referred to as the hard bracelet as they moved into the solar system. The Anunnaki counted the planets from the outside in, so they called the Earth the seventh planet, because coming in you would have Pluto, Uranus, Neptune, so on, Mars, and then to the Earth. But they called that region that we call the asteroid belt, they called it the hard bracelet. So I think the hard bracelet was formed when Mars destroyed another planet in a interplanetary war.
All right, do you want to hear another story on that one? How this all happened. Okay, so...
Great tale.
This story comes from Michael Tesserian from the Vedas. We aforementioned the Vedas.
Yes, it did.
Okay, so, and it all came personally to me as a reading that I had from a psychic woman. And she said, they left you behind. Because, like, I was like, how did I get here? And they left you behind, all right? So, here's the story, right? In the very old days, this sector was dominated by reptilians. And, presumably part of the, all right, so the reptilians attacked, Lyra. You know that one?
Yes.
All right. So, in order to sort of start taking back the galaxy from the reptilians, the Pleiadians, who had gone into the future to replan, they sent a mission back into the past. Okay? And they came through the sun as a time portal, and they went in and they took out Mars with an EMP device. Then all right, so we'll talk about that in a minute. And that would blindside the reptilian base so that they could then send in a bunker buster to destroy the base that was on Maldek or Marduk. Or Tiamat. They have various different names for it.
Right.
Or Shamat. Okay.
Right.
So, essentially, this was a bunker bust, and there was some kind of accelerant or some other thing. Like, you know, they may have had a big pile of red mercury or something like that. But whatever they used to blow up the base ended up blowing the planet up. Yes. And that becomes thousands of globules of water containing fish, frogs, amphibians, algae, seaweed, all sorts of bits and pieces. These become ecospheres. And we call them meteors.
Yes, and they bring life to Earth.
And fish fall from the sky.
Right.
Because there was a shoal of fish in a lump of stuff, and it was a, you know, it didn't, you know, thawed out and blap, whole bunch of fish or frogs, you know. So the idea of, also, Mars. So then let's go back to Mars. In order to take out the early warning systems that were placed on Mars, which was a moon of Maldek at the time, there was, the idea was to, send an EMP device to explode an airburst over the reptilian base, just to blind it. However, what they didn't know, and what I surmise happened, was that Mars had been so fracked, for oil, is that, because, you know, wherever they go, they do the same thing, that the atmosphere was volatile, and when they set off the EMP, it, it set fire to the volatile atmosphere, and that's what killed Mars.
Well, you know, as I said, there is some basis, in fact, for what you said. A friend of mine named Dr. John Brandenburg, PhD, wrote a book called Life and Death on Mars, and he was working with the data from Mars, and he found a particular element called xenon 29, which is a radioactive isotope that is only produced in nuclear hydrogen explosions, and they found it scattered all over Mars. And when he presented this data to an expert who was an expert in nuclear physics, he says the man was going through the list of minerals and molecules, stuff, residue they found. When he came to xenon 29 and he saw the amount that was registered, his eyes bugged out, and he looked at him, and he said, oh, my God, this could only mean one thing. And Brandenburg knew what that one thing was, and then they expressed it, and then the guy didn't want to talk to him at all ever again about the subject. But he's written this book called Life and Death on Mars, The New Mars Synthesis by John Brandenburg. And if you'd be interested in speaking to him, I'd be happy to try to connect you. I have, you know, we're in contact by email. And I'm sure he's always happy to talk about Mars. But he confirmed an observation that I made. What I'm saying to you folks is eyewitness, because eyewitness testimony. Because in 2003, when Mars came closest to the Earth than it had in 60,000 years, I felt compelled to buy the best telescope I could buy in order to see this event. And I had an awesome, earth-shaking, frightening experience. When I saw Mars on August 28th and 29th of 2003, Mars was as close as it would appear to be just a little farther through the telescope. The size of Mars appeared to me as if the moon were just a little farther away from us than it is. It's like 250,000 miles. It would have been like 280,000 miles. And I got to see the real planet Mars. And in one glance, I saw how terribly deceived we have been by NASA and the Hubble photographs and the satellite photos that they had been sending up to that time in 2003. They had been showing us a dead, barren desert planet. And when I looked through that telescope and saw the most beautiful pink air glow of the atmosphere of Mars, I saw lightnings that went from the North Pole to the South Pole of Mars. And these were plasma streams. I was talking about the Aurora Borealis and on Earth. And that is plasma that hovers around the North Pole in the Arctic Circle. What I saw, I had to coin a new word for it, and I called it Aurora Australo-Borealis, because it went from south to north and north to south. I also saw clouds, long columns, but columns that were horizontal, that were rolling off the Tarsus bulge like logs. And these clouds, roll clouds they're called, were about 1,000 miles long. Then I looked, and I saw a living, breathing, dynamic planet. And then I looked at the center of the planet, and this was on the first night, and I saw a black spot coming around the horizon. And over the course of the next hour and a half, that black spot turned and turned and turned until it faced me fully. And when I looked at it, I saw what I call the Eye of Mars. And what the Eye of Mars looked like was this brilliant orange-pink globe with an air glow all around it and lightning streaming over it, and with a black pupil looking at me with a black tear running out, like Alice Cooper's eye. That Alice Cooper eye with the black tear coming down, I saw Mars looking at me like that. And when I saw that, I grew frightened in the pit of my stomach, because I realized that I was looking at the Martian Holocaust. I was looking at a meteor impact that had hit and created Solus Locus, a pit so deep that sunlight does not start to reach the bottom until the sun is high at 11 o'clock, 10 o'clock. So this was early morning on Mars, and the whole Martian globe was bathed in light except this pit. And that eye looked at me, and I realized that I was looking at the death of Mars, that it had been destroyed in one day, one moment, one instant. An asteroid so big had struck Mars that it cracked the Valles Marineris, 2,400 miles, that it dented the planet inward. It cracked the Valles Marineris and submerged that section below the Tarsus Bulge. It created a palisade of cliffs that's 1,000 miles long. And that land stayed up, and the rest of it went down. And Mars was destroyed, its ecosystem, its everything on it. Tidal waves rushed across the planet, inundating everything, and Mars died in one night. On a second night, I saw another impact crater, which to my utter amazement was still smoking. It looked to me like I was looking at a recently impacted huge meteor crater in the southern region of Mars, and it was oval in shape. And my telescope, I had a 128X telescope with Mars at the closest point to Earth it had come to in 60,000 years, which is about 34 million miles. And I looked, and vapor was steaming off this impact crater. And as the vapor rose, it also sank. There were waves, and it was a rainbow, rainbow light, rainbow waves were in this crater. And on the sides, I could see the sides of the crater were striated and red, very much like the Grand Canyon. And I wondered what this thing was that I was looking at. So I went and looked on my Mars chart, and I was looking at the Hellas Basin. And I said, the Hellas Basin is steaming. And I've always said that Mars had an atmosphere, despite NASA's denials. Well, the very next day, I wrote it up. I described the description I've given you. The following day, NASA came out with a press release saying that the Hellas Basin is a sea, S-E-A, of CO2. It is a sealed lake, basically, of carbon dioxide. And their explanation for it is that the carbon dioxide is kept compressed in the Hellas Basin by planetary winds that sweep so rapidly across the top of the Hellas Basin that they act like a lid on a kettle and make them condense. So, Mars is alive. Mars has never been dead completely. And if you look at the movie, you see the movie Mission to Mars, what I've described to you is depicted in the end of the movie in a holographic form when the astronauts finally get into the face on Mars and get into the holographic room. What I've told you is what they depict. And the story that ensues is that a Martian Isis, goddess Isis, a Martian goddess geneticist, took the Martian genome and planted here on Earth for all these divergent life forms to evolve. So I came from Mars, but I don't want to go back. I like it here. Much nicer planet.
How did you get here? Well, I came from Mars. You know, it's a very interesting thing because they say men are from Mars and women from Venus.
Yes.
It could be quite possible that the Earth is full of refugees.
Absolutely. You know, talk about refugees. Who is a greater refugee than Bigfoot? He is a mystery, but he is an expanding mystery.
Oh, I have more intel on that.
Oh, brother. You know, I've been following Bigfoot since 1958. I was 10 years old when I first heard about Bigfoot. So that's 59 years of Bigfoot studies.
All right.
And I always kept track of Bigfoot maps, you know, sighting maps. And over the decades, I've noticed that Bigfoot isn't getting fewer. Bigfoot is expanding, and Bigfoot expanded from the Canadian Rockies and the American Northwest and slowly migrated down into Ohio and then Pennsylvania. And there's a very good Bigfoot special on Mystery Quest that I've seen a few times, but you can check it out. And they show you the chart of all the Bigfoot sightings over the years, and you realize that people are seeing Bigfoot farther and farther and farther south across the United States and Canada as well. And in Canada, propagating all off to the east. So Bigfoot is a phenomenon that is growing, not diminishing. And I think because it's expanding. I think it's populating.
Mm-hmm. Okay, do you want to hear some intel on this? This is all from the interviews that I've had and the interviews that I produced on Wolf Spirit Radio over the years, right? This is all from this. And you can, you know, if anybody wants to listen back and, you know, check all this, but I can, you know, kind of give it all from, this is what I've learned so far. Right. We had a Bigfoot contactee. Actually himself, 6'8".
Wow.
All right. So yeah. There's some kind of connection there. But, he was, you know, cause I said, you know, where you come from? What do you know? Do you come from Earth and all this stuff? And, he said that they came from Maldek and that they knew that destruction was happening and that they left Maldek through the pyramid system to come to Earth as refugees.
Hmm.
How about that?
Let me say this. I think we're playing this kind of a mental ping pong and association. And what your anecdote sparked in me is a recollection from my brother. My brother's also very psychic. We've both been psychic from the cradle, and my brother had a dream many, many years ago that he was in Egypt and that all of a sudden he was caught in this nuclear explosion, but he hid and shielded himself, and the nuclear blast blew by. And when he stood up and looked, the Great Pyramid of Giza had been exposed and all of the sands had been blown away. And the Pyramid of Giza was the top, the apex of an obelisk that went down hundreds and hundreds of feet, now exposed. Then he told me, and this is years and years and years before this was discovered, he told me in the same dream that he went into it and that he found a subterranean city with tremendous number of chambers and tunnels, and that he was wandering down there for a very long time. And that it was populated down there by very unusual beings that could not come up into the light. And that also is an explanation for what I call the Thonic gods, you know, the ancient gods, the underworld gods.
Yeah, yeah. So because they couldn't come out into the light, so people had to go down into the tunnels to talk to them.
Yeah, it's not that they were evil or anything. I associate it with radiation, heat, and air pressure. and that for that reason, some of the gods alighted on mountains and had to stay on mountains. And I think that had to do with temperature, Mars being farther away, colder, a thinner atmosphere even then because it's a smaller planet, and that these so-called gods can't take the air pressure at sea level because it is a tremendous amount. I mean, we don't realize how strong our bodies are to be able to hold off the weight of the atmosphere. Calculate how many square inches there are in your area, your body area, and 14.7 pounds per square inch. It adds up. And, you know, go down into a swimming pool, go down about 15 feet and feel another atmosphere. So I think pressure, the pressure gradient is very important in their sense of well-being. And then there's another group which can take the pressure but can't take the light. And that's the group that I believe I would classify as the reptilians, not enamored of light and have to shield themselves from the radiation. So there are these several categories of gods, you know, mountain gods and sonic gods, underworld gods, and so on. But these are all really extraterrestrials with higher mental powers and a higher science that Arthur C. Clarke said any sufficiently advanced technology would be indistinguishable to us from magic.
So exactly.
Over to you.
Exactly. So here's just to kind of wrap things up. Are you a Doctor Who fan?
Oh, you know, I've come to Doctor Who very, very, very late in my life.
All right.
Only about, I think, 10 years ago, something like that. He's been around since the 60s, right?
Since the day of the assassination of JFK.
Oh, my God.
The first Doctor Who episode came out on the same day. So it just like, oh, what a way to start, you know. Sorry, we just interrupt this program to...
That's fine, no, really. I like to hold things in historic perspective. It's interesting. The reason I came to become familiar with Doctor Who was because I had a run-in with some very subversive types who were using false names during the 9/11 period. And that terrorism period, I had a run-in with a cell of terrorists, and one of them, one of their leaders, took on the name Tulok. And I had never heard that name, and so I looked up on the internet, and the only Tulok that I found was a character in Doctor Who, which, strangely enough, looked quite a bit like this guy. It wasn't the same guy, but apparently he'd taken on this as an alter ego, this villain, because this fellow Tulok was not a good guy in the Doctor Who saga. So that's how I came to it. And so what do you have to...
So here's the thing. My thing about Doctor Who.
Yeah.
The most evil thing in the Doctor Who universe... all through the whole thing, is this machine, organic, hybrid thing called a Dalek.
Oh, the Dalek, yeah. Right?
Now, the Dalek, to me, is not only the epitome of everything Nazi, I believe that it has the engraving of Die Glocke. This is bringing it all the way back. It has the Die Glocke form. It's like a kind of, it looks like the banana. It's a kind of, you know, ice cream cone shape.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, what the word, it struck me that the word Dalek is also associated in the 1940s with detrimental robots. You know, the Dalek was another name, an esoteric name for extraterrestrials in the Roswell crash. There's some...
Is that so? No, I didn't know that.
They didn't have a word for them, you know, in 1947. These things crashed in the desert. Extraterrestrial is a word that was coined much later. They had words, they called them Celestians because they came from heaven, right? Celestians, that was one word. But there was this word, two words were Dalek was one of them, and Dawaz. You know the famous Roswell photograph of General Ramey debunking with the weather balloon, but he's holding a telegram, right? And one of my colleagues was able to go right into the telegram with new technology and read the telegram, and it referred to the creatures in the craft as Dawaz. So Dawaz and Daleks are also alternate words for extraterrestrial. But while you make that point, I want to point out to the audience that in Battlestar Galactica, the enemy was this machine, inorganic machine, hive mind.
Oh, yeah, the Cylon.
The Cylons. But do you remember who their leader was?
Oh, no.
You know, this is an amazing thing. Everyone has seen Battlestar Galactica, and when I pose this question, everybody remembers every detail except this detail.
I tell you, the one thing I remember about Battlestar Galactica was that there was...
The thing that's been erased is the name of their leader, and you can't remember it, but it was Lucifer.
Really?
Yes, sir. The high Cylon, the highest Cylon of all Cylons at the end. He is a machine intelligence who despises humanity, and his name is Lucifer. And I think
well.
Tell us something about it then.
It certainly does.
Yeah, it seems to be in the formulation, you know. You know that I just saw an article here in America that somebody is starting a religion, is incorporating a church of the God of artificial intelligence. They are planning to worship artificial intelligence as God.
Oh, that'll be Tectatron. He's getting up to those. Yeah, we've met Tectatron. He's like the future version of Metatron who turns everybody into, that's the singularity kind of semi-deity.
You know, Metatron is, the real Metatron is actually another name for the Messiah. Metatron is the angel of the revelation in Judaism and in the Arcana and the Kabbalah. Christ is Metatron, Metatron to come. So again, they're perverting the name by casting it on, something negative.
So it's a machine intelligence. So.
Yeah.
That's very interesting, because that ties up with loads and loads of sci-fi villains. Is this machine Borg? You know, there's the Borg.
The Borg. Yeah. I never liked Borg.
Yeah, oh no, they were really scary. But here's the thing, you know, we had the Klingons, who are now the Klingons on the Discovery. I'm quite enjoying it. Long story, but because we've only got a couple of minutes left. But first we had the Klingons, and then we had the Borg. But what we have to realize is that the actual real reality of the reptilians, the Draco reptilians, is that they are both. They are the Borg with reptilian bodies. And, that's the idea of Anu. So he's not a very nice guy.
Yes, Anu is not a pleasant person. And I call it a person. I don't call him a god. But they really foisted, a real big trick on humanity. And, The description of the creation of the human is really diabolical, quite diabolical, you know, when the gods and Ningyoshita get together and they expel their own secretions and meld them and mix the clay. But the really strange part, which is fascinating, is that they kill an Igiji, one of the lesser gods. They kill the Igiji, rip out his soul, and stick it into what I would call at that point the homunculus. And then they wrap it all up and they put it in Ningyoshita and she gestates it and produces Adam. And that soul of the Igiji is the immortal part of the human being. And they found out how to transfer that immortal part of that lesser god, infuse it into flesh, and make the flesh keep transferring that, and to propagate it. And it's a fascinating part of the story. But it's all about manipulation, genetic engineering, and then foisting a false reality on the thing that has been created.
That's right. Giving it a story.
Yeah.
Listen, Robert, it's been absolutely, absolutely
fascinating.
Because we're completely out of time. It's zipped by. It's just like we've taken a time machine to 2 hours in the future from where we started. Except the Skype reception is a lot better now.
Yes, and it's a much better future for us having done so.
Much better. Thank you very much for hanging out with me. It's been I love doing spontaneous things, and you're so good at it. You've always risen to like okay,
and you as well. I think that this is what makes for a very interesting radio, not stilted, not scripted, spontaneous, creative, brainstorming.
Absolutely,
that's great. So thank you. It was a pleasure, and I hope we do it again.
Robert Morningstar, thank you very much.
Good night.
This has been Ever Beyond. Stay tuned for the World Healers Group. Beyond.